All the leaves are green.
All the leaves are green.
And the sky's not gray.
And the sky's not gray.
Bring the preacher and the
rice.
It's our wedding day.
We would just be dreaming
if we weren't in L.A.
If we weren't in L.A.
California gay men. Stopped into a church and said, now we are gay.
Yeah, we got down on our
knees
and we began to pray. Since we both are wedding planners,
what's the odds?
We planned it right away.
Planned it right away.
California gay men.
California gay men.
Our fairy tales today. Do you promise to love, honor, and be fabulous to each other? Do you promise to share the PT Cruiser and never let your abs lose definition? And do both of you promise that your divorce from Liza Minnelli is final? Then I am pleased to announce you as man and governor of New Jersey. California gay man!
California gay man!
We'll have our wedding day!
Walking down the aisle
to YMCA.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to What Does a Police State Look Like? You can hear this program at 96.5 FM, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
It's This American Life from Ira Glass. Our show today, Right to Remain Silent. We have two stories of people who very much do not choose to remain silent. We've arrived at Act 2 of our show. Act 2. Is that a tape recorder in your pocket, or are you just unhappy to see me? Adrian Schoolcraft is a New York City policeman who decided to secretly record himself and his fellow officers on the job all day, every workday, he says, for 17 months, including lots of days when he was ordered to do all kinds of things cops are not supposed to do. It's led to a small scandal, several people removed from their jobs, and at least four investigations of the New York Police Department. Though Adrian insists he didn't get into this looking for trouble.
His father was a police officer, and I would say he went along with the program for a few years.
This is a reporter who broke the story in the Village Voice about Adrian and what he recorded those 17 months, a reporter named Graham Raymond. When I asked Graham what Adrian, the person at the center of this scandal, is like, the first thing out of his mouth is...
I would describe him as an extremely earnest person, almost in this cynical age, almost to the point of... almost too earnest. Like, he actually believed that he could get the police commission to change certain things about how the police department is being run.
Adrian Schoolcraft was working in Brooklyn, Precinct 81, in Bedford-Stuyvesant, a rough neighborhood, mostly black, that was slowly gentrifying. The precinct is just 7 blocks wide and 20 blocks long, roughly, and has had about a dozen murders a year in recent years, which is a lot, but a third of what it used to be. Adrian's kind of an electronics buff, and he bought himself one of those tiny digital recorders, tucked it into his breast pocket, and started recording as he walked his beat when he talked to other cops.
Attention, roll call.
Morning roll calls.
The only reason the thought entered my head was because to protect myself.
This is Adrian.
Like any other officer would carry a recorder, was to protect themselves from any false accusations, usually from civilians who are upset.
How big was the recorder?
Oh, about the size of a pack of gum.
The atmosphere at the 81st Precinct was set by its commander, Stephen Mariello. When Mariello showed up, Adrian Schoolcraft says, things changed. Officers were told to write more tickets, do more stop and frisks, arrest more people for low-level offenses they might otherwise let go. Get their numbers up.
The pressure definitely increased when he arrived and took over as the commanding officer. The analogy I would use is like having a boot to the back of your heel. It is do this or else. The rent's due.
The rent's due.
The rent is due. Pay the rent. Did you pay the rent last month?
Pay the rent means like, did you get your numbers?
Correct.
Now, it's perfectly legal for police to be told, like anybody in any job, here's the amount of work that we expect you to do, the number of tickets and arrests that are normal for somebody in your job in this neighborhood. But what's not allowed is to penalize police officers who do not make those targets. We don't want police officers under such pressure to deliver numbers that they make stops and arrests and write summonses with no valid reason just to get their goals. Again, reporter Graham Raymond.
In other words, as a police supervisor, I can't tell you, you better give me 20 tickets a month or else I'm going to transfer you to the graveyard shift. There can't be a direct relationship between the two.
That's just against the rules.
It's against the law.
It's against the law.
Yeah, there's a state law against that kind of thing. But what was happening in the precinct and what the tapes show repeatedly is that they were tying it to disciplinary action. They were threatening the cops. If you don't hit your numbers, you'll get transferred, you'll lose your assignment, we'll change your partner, you'll go to a foot post, you'll be given a worse assignment.
On November 1st, 2008, one sergeant declares at a roll call, quote, "They are looking at these numbers and people are going to be moved. They can make your job real uncomfortable, and we all know what that means." On December 8th, 2008, a sergeant tells the officers that if they don't get their activity up, quote, "There's some people here that may not be here come next month." Because officially, the NYPD doesn't allow numeric quotas to be tied to job performance. You hear the supervisors in the recording sometimes get into real verbal contortions to get the point across, like in this excerpt from a roll call the first month that Schoolcraft was recording, June 2008.
The XO was in the other day. I don't know who was here. He actually laid down a number.
I'm just going to repeat the six. It's hard to hear. The XO was in the other day. That's the commanding officer, right? Yeah. Or the executive officer. Was in the other day. He laid down a number.
All right, so I'm not going to quote him on that because I don't want to be quoted. Stating numbers.
I'm not going to quote him on that because I don't want to be quoted stating numbers.
All right. He wants at least 3 seatbelts, 1 cell phone, and 11 others.
He wants 3 seatbelts, 1 cell phone, and 11 others. What does that mean?
He wants 3 seatbelt summonses, tickets for people not wearing their seatbelt, 1 cell phone, someone driving in their car talking on the cell phone, and 11 others. There are dozens of other categories of summonses that you can give people.
I don't know what the number is, but that's what he wants.
I don't know what the number is, but that's what he wants. That's a really, what does that mean?
He's playing the same game. He knows he's not supposed to state a number, but he wants to get his point across. So he's kind of, it's kind of like, if you remember All the President's Men, it's a non-denial denial.
Adrian Schoolcraft says he isn't exactly sure when, but at some point he decided that it was important to document the orders that he was given, that he thought were out of line. He recorded roll calls where officers were constantly being told to do more stop and frisks, even though it's illegal to stop a random person on the street and frisk them without reasonable suspicion. In December 2008, a sergeant tells officers to stop and frisk, quote, anybody walking around, no matter what the explanation is. He recorded Stephen Mariello, the commander of the 81st Precinct, and the person Adrian Schoolcraft says really brought the hammer down for higher numbers, ordering the officers to arrest everyone they see. This happens in a couple of recordings, like this one, from Halloween 2008.
Any roving bands, you hear me? Roving bands of more than 2 or 3 people.
He's saying any roving bands of more than 2 or 3 people. He's talking about just people going around on Halloween night.
I want them stopped.
I want them stopped.
Cuffed. Throw in here, run some warrants.
Throw them in here, run some warrants.
You're on a foot post, take the first guy you got, and lock them all up, boom.
You're on a foot post, F it. Take the first guy you've got, lock them all up, boom.
You go back out and process it later on. I have no problem, a little overtime.
Go back out, and then we'll come back in and process them later on.
Yes, yeah, what he's saying is arrest people simply for the purpose of clearing the streets.
Again, Graham Raymond. He says the problem with that is
there has to be a violation of the law to make an arrest. He's essentially making the arrest before the crime takes place.
This is an example of something that I would say they're going out in the street and just grabbing people. That's unlawful imprisonment. It's an illegal arrest.
That's John Eterno, a former New York City cop who went up the ranks from officer to sergeant to lieutenant and captain. He now chairs the Department of Criminal Justice at Molloy College and researches and writes about police practices with Professor Eli Silverman. And he says that some of the things that Adrian Schoolcraft documented on his recordings were no surprise to anybody, like sergeants hounding officers to get their numbers up. That's been happening in every precinct for a long time, he says. But for commanders to tell cops to just lock people up and figure it out later. Turner says the word for that is kidnapping.
That's exactly what it is. They're just pulling people off the street. It's an unlawful imprisonment. And they're being kidnapped. If they don't have probable cause, you cannot grab people off the street. It is kidnapping. At this point, from what I'm hearing on this tape, it seems to me that this is probably illegal behavior that's taking place on the part of the police department.
We were arrested. They take us to the 81st precinct, put us in lockup for maybe an hour or two, and you know they processed us and checked for warrants, and once they seen no warrants, you know, they let us go, but we were still issued a citation.
Andre Wade has lived in the neighborhood for over 20 years. He's a commercial driver. One day he and 2 friends were picking up his brother to go to work together. Right, they were standing on the sidewalk, and a police officer came over, said they were trespassing. When his brother came down and confirmed no, they were there to pick him up, Andre says the officer wouldn't listen.
He was just saying stuff like, you know you're not supposed to be standing here. he started getting upset when we were, you know, like trying to talk him out of giving us the citations, you know. And it's like he just got out of control. He got real erratic and, you know, got on the radio. And next thing you know, when we turn around, it's like 8-9 police cars. You know, it was to the point to where you would think that somebody was getting arrested for murder or something like that, you know. And it was just, you know, like jumping out of their vehicles and, you know, and me and my buddies already knew that, you know, that we were in for a ride.
The citation that the police gave Wade was his name, the day that he's supposed to appear in court, but in the spot where it's supposed to specify his crime.
Yes, in that field of the ticket, there was nothing. No violation. The violation was blank.
Thank you.
And now, back to what does a police state look like?
One of the producers of our radio show lives in the 81st Precinct. And she says that it's one of those neighborhoods where everybody has stories of ridiculous tickets. One of her neighbors was bringing his aunt home from the hospital and double parked. Two officers told him to move his car, and when he didn't, he was handcuffed, forced to lie down in the street, and tasered twice, all in front of a crowd of people, including her, who live on the block and heard him calling for help. One common citation is for having an open container of alcohol. One neighbor says he was walking home from church with his six-year-old daughter, drinking a small carton of Tropicana orange juice, and he got a ticket for that. Others got tickets for water or Gatorade that was being given away at the park. George Walker has lived on the same block for over 40 years and says older guys like him get a lot of tickets. He thinks maybe they're targeted because they don't give the cops any fuss. He says he's gotten a dozen tickets this past year, nearly all for open container, even though he says he wasn't drinking alcohol.
Every last ticket was dismissed. Everyone was not a valid ticket. Because you have to name, if you see someone drinking alcohol and you give them a ticket for open container, you have to name what they were drinking. But if they can't name it, they say cup with alcohol in it. But that's not the name of the alcohol, so it gets dismissed. Because it wasn't alcohol in the first place. But, I don't know, they feel like they could do anything they want to us.
So in this police station where everybody's obsessed with how many tickets they're writing, where cops are told to pull people off corners and throw them in jail and figure out later what to charge them with, comes Adrian Schoolcraft, who had no interest in making his numbers.
No, I never tried to make anything happen. I went out there and you walk your beat. Whatever happened, happened.
When you would talk to other officers in the precinct, did you have friends who felt the same way?
Yes.
And would they not get the numbers or would they get the numbers?
They would get the numbers. It's easier, especially if you have a wife, kids, and then they're devoted to their pension and retiring.
Do you not have a wife and kids?
No.
And so you wouldn't go up to people just to give them a ticket?
No.
Because?
It just wasn't right. I found I was getting along with a lot of the business owners, the local business owners, and I started interacting with the residents, and they would tell me who the problems were. Now, if you start messing with the residents and you start going into the barber shops and writing summons that I don't feel police officers have any business writing, they didn't sweep the floor of hair. These are the same people that could help you perform your job as a patrolman or a police officer. That was my philosophy, and it did work.
And so did you get a lot of heat for doing this?
Heat was pressure from supervisors.
What would they do?
Well, I think they consider the foot post punishment, but I always enjoyed the foot post. But there's also hospitalized prisoners, prisoner transports.
So they would assign you to these lousy posts?
You know, to get my mind right, they would try those. But I accepted those as normal duties as a police officer.
But we still haven't gotten to the most disturbing thing documented by Adrian Schoolcraft in his recordings. Schoolcraft shows, over and over, that sometimes, when real crimes would happen, serious crimes, the 81st Precinct would reclassify them as lesser crimes, or simply not put them in the system at all, to make it look like the precinct was doing a better job driving down crime rates than it really was. Again, reporter Graham Raymond.
I mean, there's a remarkable conversation that Schoolcraft has with another officer.
Or it must be the cutoff
and
of the quarter.
The other officer is just telling him three anecdotes of how the precinct commander and supervisor basically dumped three criminal complaints that should have been recorded.
Yeah, what are the stories that he tells?
One is this: a young woman reports her cell phone was robbed, and the precinct commander basically says,
"What do you want me to do? What do you want to do with this?
What do you want us to do with this? How are we going to solve this? Are you going to get your phone back? You're not going to get your phone back."
And he's like, "Well, what if we can't get it back?" He's like, "Are you going to press charges?"
He basically talks her out of filing a complaint, and that should be a robbery that should go in their numbers. But one of the other ones is, the precinct commander responds to a report of a stolen vehicle, and he says his first question is, he asks the victim, is, "Have you done jail time?"
He's like, "You ever been arrested before?" He's like, "Yeah." He's like, "What for?"
Which is not really a proper question to ask of a crime victim, but he asks it, and the guy says, "Yes, yeah, I did 8 years in prison when I was younger." And the precinct commander says, "Maybe karma stole your car."
Yeah. So you think maybe karma woke up this morning and took your car?
Karma is in, like, the spiritual.
Yeah. He was like, "No, I don't think karma takes cars." So he's like, "I think somebody took my car."
He didn't take his report because he's a felon?
Yeah, basically.
In the end, this cop tells Adrian, their supervisor, Stephen Mariello, told him to file the case as an unauthorized driver.
Meaning that the guy loaned his car to somebody else who who now has it.
When the officer tried to file it that way, because he didn't have a name for the unauthorized driver, he couldn't file it at all. So the robbery went unreported. Rules go into effect in the 81st precinct that make it harder to report serious crimes. Officers are told that if there's a robbery, one of their supervisors has to come out to the scene themselves. And robbery victims are told that if they don't come into the police station, no crime report will be filed at all. After Graham Raymond started publishing these stories about Adrian Schoolcraft, retired cops and some on-duty cops started contacting him with their own anecdotes about crimes being downgraded from serious to much less serious. The most shocking of these, from a high-ranking detective named Harold Hernandez.
He's a very distinguished detective. He was working in the 33rd Precinct in Washington Heights, and one morning he comes into work, and there's a guy who's accused of first-degree rape sitting in his interview room. So he sits down, and he looks at the guy, and he says, and he has a little twinge, and he says, "Have you ever done this before?" And the guy said, "Yeah." And Hernandez says, "How many times?" He says, "Oh, I don't know, 7 or 8. And Hernandez says, "Where?" He goes, "In this neighborhood." And Hernandez is now dumbstruck because he has had there's been no report of a serial rapist, sexual predator working in the neighborhood.
Like no crimes have shown up. People haven't shown up saying they've been raped or assaulted.
He hasn't been notified. And he would be notified as a senior detective in the unit. It would be a very big deal. And so he says, "Can you give me the dates and locations?" And the guy says, "Well, I can try, but you're going to have to take me around and I'll show you. So he and a fellow detective get in the car and they drive around and they look. And the suspect, whose name is Daryl Thomas, points out the locations. And then Hernandez takes his notebook and he writes down the locations. And then he goes back and he looks through stacks of crime complaints and he finds them. And he realizes that they've been classified, they've been downgraded. They've been classified either as criminal trespassing or criminal possession of a weapon, both relatively minor crimes, given that the actual conduct in the narrative that the victims are describing is either first-degree burglary, robbery, or sexual abuse, sexual assault. And he confronts his bosses about it. He confronts the precinct commander and he confronts his detective squad commander, and everyone just shrugs. Meanwhile, everyone's terrified that it's going to come out. These women are going to go to the press, and it's going to be a huge embarrassment, a huge scandal for the department. And if it had come out, it would have been a huge scandal for the department. But the department was able to keep it quiet. The district attorney's office prosecuted Thomas, and he went away for 50 years. But here's the interesting part. They never publicized the case. There's never a press release issued about it. There was never a news article written about the case.
Normally, Graham says, a case like this, serial rapist, they try to get some press. But the misclassifications of the crimes would have made the NYPD look bad.
No one was ever disciplined for what happened, for downgrading. The precinct commander was promoted twice by Commissioner Kelly.
The guy who was in charge of that precinct where all this stuff happened?
Where this stuff happened. He's been promoted twice. You know, it just went on business as usual. Hernandez, here's a guy who probably would have stayed in the department for 35 years, 30, 35 years, as long as he could. But he was so upset about this incident and about other instances of downgrading and of manipulation of the crime stats that he retired.
And so the NYPD has denied that crimes are downgraded like this.
Yeah, well, they've said that it only happens in a very tiny percentage of cases, and they say that the crime stats are audited very carefully, and if it was a wider problem, it would be spotted.
The New York Police Department declined our request to come onto the radio or to have the officers who supervised Adrian Schoolcraft and who were heard on his recordings to be interviewed about their side of all this. But the pressure on police commanders to get better numbers really goes back to 1994, when New York started tracking crimes with a system called CompStat. CompStat, for the first time, gave commanders timely, accurate data once a week on what crimes are happening so they could send more cops to deal with it. Chances are you've heard of all this. It became one of the best-known successes in modern policing. Serious crime has dropped an astonishing 74% in New York City since 1993, the year before CompStat began. Other cities very quickly started imitating it, D.C., Philly, L.A. Baltimore's version of CompStat ended up in a recurring plotline on the TV show The Wire, where street cops were told by their bosses to do anything to pump up their numbers.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we want with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore. No, I ain't marching anymore.
And now for something completely different.